The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
You know, in terms of contextualization, that's why some of us have argued that the danger has been that you are reducing today discussions of contextualization, all that kind of business, to just sort of neat little tricks. And, you know, one more bag of tricks the evangelical can carry with them to the jungle along with gospel recordings and cassette tapes and little pictures of the four laws or the five laws or whatever you want. And contextualization in its deepest sense isn't that. It's basically boils down to how can I live out the gospel in my culture.
Can one person contextualize the gospel for two people at the same time? Thinking of white masters and black servants in South Africa, because they're intrinsically involved with each other and yet they're completely different people. And the gospel in context to the one is their salvation, but the salvation of the one is the death of the other, and vice versa.
I haven't thought of that one. Let me take this guess, Peter. Let me say it would probably be easier for a black servant to contextualize the gospel for a white master than vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
When you are in an oppressor role in a culture, it's almost impossible in the by the very nature of the role you play for you to be contextualizing.
Mm-hmm.
The gospel's got to come with love. And your very role denies everything that the gospel is. It can happen also with those who are oppressed, you know, but I would think it'd be a little bit easier the other way. If I was a white slave owner, it would be easier for me, it would be easier for a slave to present the gospel to me from the point of view of communication than vice versa. And from the point of view of if I hear him or not.
But if you take a third party, like a missionary, going to the house of the slave owner and speaking to the slaves and the slave owners, because the hope of the slave is the fear of the owners.
Ah.
And the hope of the owners is the fear of the slave.
Yeah, I see. Yeah.
And that's the big problem we face.
Well,
but you don't have to answer it now, for me.
If
you just do it yourself with one part of the population by contextualizing satisfactorily at the other side.
Yeah.
And whatever you do, you burn your finger.
Right. Maybe in that sense, maybe this is just sort of theologizing right now, but isn't part of that where the risk of the gospel comes, and where if in doing that, if you realize what's happening now is I'm taking up my cross for Jesus, then part of the very nature of the suffering of the gospel comes because you're going to have to do that. You may have to stand assault both sides and comfort both sides and be judged by both sides. And that's what Jesus means by taking up your cross. Although I think probably strategically speaking, I would guess in a situation like that, in terms of a biblical commitment to the poor, I would probably feel that as a contextualizer, the place I would have to stand, first of all, would be with the poor, no matter what, or with those who are oppressed. So that even when I spoke to the oppressor, it would be, at least from that point of view, as one who identified with the oppressed. But at the same time, I would also have to call the oppressed to patience, to humility, to love and grace, even as I stood for them. And I'm sure they would hate me from that point of view as much as the oppressor would. But I would think that's where you have to move, at least in terms of the answer to that might depend on how you see the biblical obligation, your biblical obligations for the poor, and where you have to stand in that relationship. Let me mention, in terms of these definitions, some of the advantages, and I'm trying to keep this stuff to as much strategy as I can, but I think there are advantages of this kind, these kinds of definitions as over against the old categories, you know, defining unreached peoples by religions or defining them by, you know, countries. And I see at least four advantages. Here is one. It does not accept this method of talking about homogeneous units or peoples, does not accept the simplistic assumptions that often are behind speaking of countries as political entities. Okay. It doesn't accept the certain simplistic assumptions that are behind, you know, talking about political things. For example, here's Nigeria. Now, within shall we talk about just the unreached peoples of Nigeria? The disadvantage to that is that there are all kinds of unreached peoples of Nigeria. Do you mean the Tiv tribal group of Nigeria? Do you mean the Hausas? Do you mean the Biafras? What do you mean, Nigerian? You know, in the Nigerian Civil War illustrates, I think, the arbitrariness of these kinds of geographical categories. They're not really, very often, the geographical categories aren't what even those people within them use to define their own identities. Peter Wagner, in his book, Our Kind of People, has a very interesting phrase. I wish we had time to talk about it. In the United States, for example, it's traditional, up until the last 20 years, to talk about the United States as a melting pot. You know, we can quote the words written under the Statue of Liberty, give me your tired, your tempest tossed, you know, I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Peter Wagner challenges that, the assumption behind that. The assumption that, as a matter of historical fact, America is a melting pot, and he questions that. He argues that America has never been a melting pot. Rather, he says, sociologically speaking, America is a stew pot. And the point he's trying to make, I think, is that America cannot be, culturally speaking, you know, just a sort of a place where you bring your culture and then it slowly disappears. Rather, it's a collection of the varied cultural mosaics of the world existing within certain political bounds. And he has some very interesting analyses of the whole, you know, the movement of the 1960s and in the 70s in the United States. The black church is in the 60s began to repudiate this melting pot kind of concept. Why? Because implicit in it was the basically the WASP mentality that said, come on, now you can be like us. And the black responded with the civil rights movement by saying, I don't want to be like you. You're not going to put me down in this subtle way. I want to be myself. So at the heart of the Black Power movement came certain slogans, Black is beautiful. And behind that slogan, a very deep effort for the black culture to identify its own integrity and authenticity within the United States. And so you have, since that time, a new focus in American culture on ethnicity, on pluralism, cultural pluralism. We have the battles in the public schools now about the legitimacy of teaching black English as a second language. In California, which is a large ethnic population, discussions about in public education about whether English should be taught as a second language and requiring the teaching of Spanish, etc. And I think all of those discussions, however you stand on them, from the one simple point of view, indicate that America is moving into at least a clearer recognition of the legitimacy of pluralism. Now, what Wagner's doing, you see, and others, is trying to use that as a methodology in terms of strategy planning. Pluralism is another name for the recognition of people groups. And even America then fits in that category. I think that's an advantage. Second advantage, it doesn't accept either the simplistic assumptions that are behind the traditional ways of talking about religions. Islam, for example. When we talk about Islam, there it is, one big lump, 700 million people. And the assumption behind that is Islam is a great sort of monolithic unit. Wherever, you don't even cross borders when you go to the Middle East, but you face this one gigantic monolithic structure that we call Islam, against which the missionary has been battering his brains out for hundreds of centuries, for hundreds of years. Again, the focus, for example, in Islamic studies, especially in the last 2 years, coming from all of this ferment of discussion, has been to see Islam not as a monolith, but rather as a gigantic mosaic of cultures. The book, it's on your reading list, it's in your bibliography, The Gospel and Islam. It's a fascinating study. Don McCurry worked with Mark on this, and is director of the Zwemer Institute now, has argued in the book that there is not one Islam, there are at least 500 Islams. That is to say, all these unique, diverse and special cultures. And I'd reinforce this. I think missionaries have frustrated themselves to death by discouragement. They look at Islam, its resistance, and they say, how are we ever going to beat it? Mm-hmm. Did you see what they're doing in Iran? Here the missionary sits in Indonesia, and he says, look what they're doing in Iran. It's the end for us. Or a missionary sits in North Africa, and he says, look what they're doing in Indonesia. Now 100 missionaries have just been informed that they have to get out of Indonesia within the next 6 months. And it looks like there is a rapid closing of the door now taking place in Indonesia among missionaries. Is there any hope at all for people who work with Muslims? And the tendency, because you have this great big monolith in front of you mentally, is not to see that within that there are all kinds of different peoples, cultural mosaics, and peoples are being won to Christ within the Islamic structure. And we don't have the information, though, to see all those different mosaics. And so we see it as one big thing and overpowering. And I think that's the danger of looking at all these religions as big blocks. Putting it another way, a religion, even a religion bearing a common name, such as Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, they are cultural continuums. They're not just religious quote-unquote things. They are cultural continuums. So for example, let's take Judaism in the United States. On one end of the continuum may be an Orthodox Jew. He eats kosher food, he keeps a kosher kitchen, he keeps the Sabbath fastidiously, marries only within his culture, wears the hat on the appropriate occasion, and goes to synagogue quite regularly. He calls himself a Jew. On the other end of the same continuum, maybe a young man, he ran away from home at the age of 14. It was the last exposure he ever had to Judaism, and his parents went twice a year to synagogue. He has become an atheist, he never attends synagogue, he never fulfills any religious ritual, and if you talk to him on the street, he says, I'm a Jew. Now, how do you explain that? And he's an atheist, but he calls himself a Jew. Because religion is not just a big thing, but it's a cultural continuum. And so you can be anywhere on that line and still identify yourself with the line. I remember when we went to India the first time, five, six of us from the seminary here together, were flying in the plane. Sitting opposite me were two young men. We started talking. They had just finished their college work studies in the United States. They were flying home to India with doctor's degrees. And they were drinking like mad. They had bought up, I think, every bottle of scotch they could in the duty-free place in New York City, and they were reading Playboy magazines. And we started talking, and when the discussion took on a religious turn, they started quieting down. And finally I asked them, I said, what are your particular beliefs? And they said they were Hindus. Now, when they, and you know, that's how they identify themselves. Should I have said, now listen to me, you're no Hindu. No, that's the way they saw themselves. They had formed, they had identified themselves in terms of that grouping. Now the danger when you look at it all like one big thing, you know, is that you've got all the answers and you've pinned everybody in the right holes. And this guy's a bardian. I know what that means. I've heard Dr. Ventil lecture. The you know, and this this gal here, she said she was you know, she was an atheist. Well, I know what that means. You know, I read R.C. Sproul's book. And we start putting people into the pigeonholes and the categories we've elaborately prepared for them, but in the process, we don't understand we're dealing with a pretty wide band here. And we don't have sensitivity for trying to find out where this person really is on that big, wide road. I think this is the great reason, that, you know, eminently for the success of the Jews for Jesus movement. Because what they've done, they've been very successful in reaching one end of the continuum and very successful in antagonizing the other. You know, you get the, every week you have a letter or you have a something in the bulletin or something from Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum attacking the Jews for Jesus, you know, and you expect it. He's Orthodox Jew, the he's blasting away. But in the meantime, the Jews for Jesus go up to New York City and they blitz the city, and all of a sudden you've got more people who've come to Christ. And they identify themselves as Jews, but they're not the Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum kind of Jew. But they have sensitivity, you know, they're looking for those units. Yeah, and I think that's why all this I find really, really helpful, even in terms of pastoring and evangelizing, you know, here in the States. Who are you aiming for? If you have a shotgun and you aim nowhere, that's exactly what you get. And if you have a congregation in the States filled with people who 95% of whom or 98% of whom have never tasted unemployment for longer than a week, if 50% of your congregation is a second house in the Poconos, if the average income is $20,000 a year, then don't sit around moaning and groaning about why you can't understand why the blacks in your neighborhood aren't coming to your church. They aren't coming to your church because those aren't the people you're aiming at. You're going to hit what you aim for. So you may have to retool if that's where you want to go. Well, anyway, I think that these, in this area too, this is the area where I would be critical of the work of J.H. Bobbitt, whom all, most of you know I commend all over the place, but I think this is really the basic defect of most of the traditional treatments of religion. They tend to, they make very few distinctions between philosophical or the more theoretical kind of part of the religion and the popular stuff. So when you think about Islam, one of the great scholars in Islam is Bishop Kenneth Craig of the Anglican Church, just a tremendous scholar and tremendous work he's done. But his whole focus of his area is on the theoretical Islam. But that's not the Islam of the streets. So where are you going to go? How do you see Islam? How do you see Judaism? How do you see the Buddhist? Don't get wrapped up with these such big generalizations that in the end you can't see peoples.
Do they propose any kind of categories by which you would define the group? Like, if you carried what you're saying out to its logical end, you could never really even have a sermon. You have to sit down one-on-one with every one of the 4.1 billion people in the world, because they're all unique, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Do they propose any categories of grouping?
I don't think so.
They do identify with each other. That's the whole point of what they're not so unique that they don't have an identity with another section of the population. And that's when you get people movement, so that the whole tribe converts at the same time.
Yeah. Right, right.
But when the movement happens, they're all moving to the church at the same time.
Yeah. If, as soon as you talk about, use the term unique, that term means I am different from this person. And you have immediately then created a boundary. You've created a boundary between yourself and somebody else or some other group. And your job then is just simply to have enough sensitivity to listen and see where the line is, what the boundary is, because it's been made. Everybody makes them. It is a very flexible kind of language and terminology. And that has been criticized in the past, and probably still is. And I think it's a criticism that needs to be made. But because one of the dangers, which I would point out, is that it can be that these homogeneous units proliferate to such a degree that the research task is never ending.
Yeah.
But I don't think that it should be drawn to that kind of a logical conclusion. Right? There are clearly discernible units, and those units are discernible enough for people to sit down with them after a period of time and be able to see that they're different. This is why I think many of the insights, contemporary missiology is using so many of the insights of cultural anthropology and sociology, because those insights are helping us to determine, to find out how do people draw their boundaries? And people draw their boundaries for very diverse reasons. They may draw their boundaries in India in terms of caste, but at the same time, the boundaries may be drawn, and sometimes in terms of language, sometimes combinations, sometimes in terms of occupations. If you worship in a church in the Philadelphia area, and let's say you have a fairly generous proportion of theological seminary students. Have you noticed the way they congregate? they've learned jargon, they've learned language in the seminary, and they can communicate along those levels, and they may frequently use it. So, the seminary students get together in church on Sunday, and they want to talk, and they'll comment on maybe something they heard in the Sunday school class, or they'll get together for coffee that night. They don't invite the butcher who sits sitting next to them in the same pew for 3 years, because sociologically they've defined at least a unit in which the butcher doesn't belong. They may create other units where he does, but you've just got to be sensitive to how they put those units together. And I think you can detect them. About 3 years ago, we had a workshop here in the seminary on planting churches in urban centers. And the course requirement, after giving the missionaries present there some reading, was to go out on the street. We sent them to Kensington area, and we told them to plot and make a statistical survey of the Kensington area and determine where they would plant churches in Kensington and why. And we said, you are to get this information without ever going to a store. You are not to visit government offices. You're to get it by talking to people on the street. So we sent out this group into the inner city, very interesting experience. One or two didn't go. There was culture shock problems. But then several of them, they really got hold of things. They started planning. And then the last morning we spent, as they read us their report of how they saw Kensington area. And they saw it very beautifully. They could tell us where the lines were. They could name the streets where, let's say, the black community was living. They could name the area which was changing. They could name the area where the Puerto Ricans were living. Well, how did you find it? Did you look it up on the street signs? No, you just look at people. Where do they walk? Where do they go to the store? You may have a street like, here's a street here. And there may be, on this whole street, there may be one store right here, let's say. And what you may find is that the people on this side of the street, even though that store is only across the street, will never go to it. They'll walk three blocks to go to a store over here. Why? Because it's in our neighborhood. And all they have to do is cross the street. What's the difference? Why? Because that store is our people. And you find those things just by looking. by keeping your eyes open, observing your neighbor, etc.
See, this kind of thinking is really what has validated the separation between South Africa and the race policy, because it's brought into the very being of man that he should congregate with what he's familiar with. And that's why it works.
Yeah.
As far as it has, it has actually worked. And they've been able to do it.
Well, we'll save that question. Yeah, I was, oh well. Let me mention a couple of other points. A third advantage. It also offers us, I think, a more workable framework for developing strategy. We're thinking in terms of strategy planning. For example, Ed Dayton makes the point in the essay, to think in terms strictly of countries offers you too many variants. What I mean is this. Okay, we sit down at this table. Lydia's obligation for our class is to prepare a strategy plan for evangelizing India. And we say to Lydia, get this ready over the weekend. You know, we give you a full expense account, phone every mission executive you want to in the United States and Canada. You've got enough money to get 500 research assistants on this whole job for the weekend and come back Monday morning with a full plan. So Lydia comes in Monday morning and we say, okay, Lydia, tell us how to evangelize India. And she says, now look, it's been a long weekend, you know, I haven't slept at all. And well, what have you found out? And she says right off, what India do you mean? And we say, well, India, I mean, how many are there? And Lydia says, well, there are, as far as I've been able to tell, there are 400 Indias, at least 400. And we say, what do you mean? And she says, informs us then, there are 400 castes in India. And that each of those castes, in terms of its makeup, in terms of who, and who, with whom it may fellowship and with whom it may not, have very distinct rules. There are at least 400. And we say, okay, we'll give you more money, and next week you can study all 400. And Lydia says, hold on a minute. That isn't the only problem. What do you mean? Well, there are 17 official languages. And in some cases, you may have one caste using 14 different languages. Now, do we divide up according to language or caste? Well, we'll give you some more money. You know, and it just goes on. And then Lydia says, well, how about the religions? Well, they're all Hindus, aren't they? Well, what about the north? Heavy concentration of Muslims. How about the south, Kerala, the state of Kerala, which has probably 80% of all the Christians in India? What are we going to do about that? You know, and which India are you talking about? How about the urban centers? They're very different from the rural area. How about what they call the cow belt, which stretches right across the central area of India? Almost no churches planted in those areas. Why aren't there? So suddenly you have so many variants in the question that just to talk about a country doesn't help. You just cannot plan strategy when you're talking in terms of countries. All you do is end up generalizing. And that's the point that Dayton is making in his book. So and I just reinforce that. When you end up generalizing, ordinarily you can end up very quickly in frustration and despair. And what can you do? How on earth are we going to reach Islam? Many decades ago, they talked about fulfilling the Great Commission in this generation. Now, are we willing to, right here and now, to plead that the Lord would enable us to bring Islam to Christ in 30 years? Boy, possible. But if we talk about bringing peoples to Christ, and if we develop a strategy where we can isolate peoples and their individuality, couldn't we talk about bringing all the peoples of the nation to Christ by the year 2000? I think you could. So that we focus on people. And our goal is to structure evangelism and the promotion of the gospel so that by the year 2000, every people will have heard Christ and have had an opportunity to make a conscious decision for or against the gospel. Fourth advantage. I think this way of talking also tries to avoid the Western acculturated patterns of Christian missions in the past. It seeks to avoid Western acculturated patterns of Christian missions from our past. What do I mean? Let me give you an example, Lydia. I think one of the deepest patterns or trends or cultural keys in understanding the North American is his heavy individualism. The American is a rugged individualist. It's bred into us by our history. Our hero is John Wayne. It's just the way we look at ourselves. It's our image of everything that's noble and good about our past and about our future. Let me ask you, Lydia. I have a hunch. If we put you in Taiwan off of the beach and you were drowning, and you wanted somebody to come, what would you say in Chinese, in Taiwanese?
In Taiwanese.
Yeah. You'd say help. Okay. What's the word?
No,
you wouldn't use that word, would you? You're drowning and you're going under.
That's
interesting. In Korea, the term that you would use if you were in a dire strait like that would be save me. You'd say salyo juseo.
Jowa.
Save me. In America, you would say help me. What's the difference between saying help me and save me?
Help me means you just need partial aid, and help save me, like total.
Yeah. Help me gives the idea of, you know, all I need is a little hand, you know, and then I can take over. But the concept in Korean is much deeper than that. It's I'm going under, and if you don't come, nobody will get me. Now, part of that is the American concept of individualism. It affects even the way we drown. But
the... If you want me to say it in English, I would say help. No. But in my heart,
Okay. All right.
Come on.
Well, I don't know Taiwanese culture enough. But I'm using this just to illustrate the heavy American individualism. Now, that individualism, I think, has affected very deeply even our approach to evangelism and world missions. It also approaches, even today, our concept of discipleship. What do you mean by discipling? In current discussions, very often discipling is defined not primarily in terms of deepening the Christian life of a brother or sister. I mean, that's part of it. But sometimes, even more, functional in the definition of discipling today is one-on-one. So often in circles, intervarsity circles I've been in, you know, youth groups, home church atmosphere, when you talk about discipling, that functional element of one-on-one is very strong in that. You know, I'm going to work with just three or four believers, maybe young people, and work with them, let them feel like they can call me up, talk to me on the phone, I'll go talk to them, but we develop that one-on-one relationship where we can cultivate. Now, I would suggest that that's cultural and not biblical. Now, I don't think, this doesn't mean I'm against one-on-one kind of discipling. But what it does mean is that idea one-on-one is not formative, biblically speaking, in terms of the biblical pattern. It's a cultural adaptation for the United States. What would happen, and usually, for example, the usual biblical defense for something like this is, well, didn't Jesus work with only 12 men for 3 years? You know, that's really one-on-one. Concentrate on the few. If we work on the small, you make good progress and then, you know, build further on. Usually forgotten in all this is the fact that Paul could talk in the book of Acts about evangelizing whole cities. And it's very difficult for me to conceive the Apostle Paul evangelizing. According to Acts 19, all who lived in Asia heard the word of the Lord, both Jews and Greeks. And I just cannot conceive of Paul spending all that time in Asia going one-on-one so that the end result, all of Asia hears the word of the Lord. And I'm not trying to poke fun at discipling because I think that's key. But what I am trying to say is that attempt to define discipling biblically by a one-on-one relationship and then argue that's biblical. It can't be done. At least recognize it's a cultural accommodation. I guess what I'm saying is that often then in evangelism as well, our patterns are adopted and structured the same way. And they have been particularly hit in evangelism by this acculturated pattern. So historically, very often missions has focused on in evangelism on the individual and bringing the individual to Christ. You'll hear this trumpeted. I've heard it in the past from Billy Graham, a need for making individual commitments to Christ.
That's putting up your hands and walking to the front.
Yeah, right. That's culturally understood too. But even then, I would suggest that that emphasis is not biblical, it's more cultural. Peter was giving examples, our patterns of even a chain of decision making are culturally conditioned. In the Orient, decisions in a traditional family structure are never made by individuals. They're made by the family. They're made by what McGavran calls multi-individual interpersonal groups. So in rural areas in Korea, I've gone to fishing villages where the entire village is made up basically of two clans or family units. And to evangelize the village, I evangelize the whole clan, and I would invite the entire clan to become Christian. You don't say at the end of a message, you know, now everybody who'd like to come to Christ, raise your hand. You say instead, I appeal to this entire village, come to Christ. And you go after the decision makers. Mm. And then you're not surprised when the whole village becomes Christian. Now,
that makes you a super evangelist because you have more notches on your belt, right?
Right. No, but well, not mine. My belt's very small. But
when you worked with prostitutes, it was on an individual basis, wasn't it? Or were you saying to all those girls, now all of you come and run to Jesus?
I would generally appeal to all. Uh-huh. And you had better chance of seeing girls come to Christ when several came. Very rarely, often also it works because of the network. I did a lot of evangelistic work with prostitutes in Korea. And you would often find that people in the brothels where you went to next knew you were coming, and they all knew who you were. And they would often respond by saying, oh yes, we heard about you from blah, blah, blah in the house up in Wijungbu. She was the one who came to Christ 2 or 3 weeks ago. And the network had already started. What McGavran calls the webs, the bridges, across which people naturally move to come to Christ. And so you figure out methodologies of using the bridges. And from that point of view, I think this is one area we got to quit, but little we got done. I would suggest that biblically, that there is more biblical warrant for focusing in our evangelism on units than on individuals. Of course, I'm speaking from my great prejudice as a Calvinist, but I think the focus, there's a reason why the Bible has a focus on families. And unfortunately, our methodology, when it has come to evangelism, often has been to focus on individuals rather than on that, you know, the family units. And yet the pictures that are drawn for us in, say, the book of Acts are preponderantly that of families who have come to Christ. Lydia and her family, the Philippian jailer, baptized with his household. But our methodological approaches have been more oriented culturally, I suspect, than biblically, and very surprising in terms of our theology. I was at a meeting several years ago now. Dr. McGavern and I were at it together on church growth up at Nyack College, and I had the Bible studies in the morning, and then Dr. McGavern the lectures, and it was really, we got going, we had one day, it was really fun, and he really was just a beautiful presentation of family units and group movements to Christ, people movements. And when it was all done, any comments now? And I shot my hand up right away, and we were feeling very wild that day, and I said, I just want to thank you, Dr. McGavern, I really do. I said, it takes somebody in the Disciples of Christ to remind me of my theological heritage. And I said, if you want some biblical basis for that, I can give you some later. And everybody roared. We went on from there. But the more you look at your scriptures, that's going to hit you.
Can I ask
you
just
go ahead.
There. So you're saying even though America is more individualistic in our thinking, it's still more biblical to approach Americans by saying you family,
yeah,
come to Christ. And
I would still do that.
Christ.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think it's been tried. I get the feeling that here, what worries me is that here in the States, the individualism, I think, has, you know, it's dropped. It's maybe there's a place in culture, and I can't tell you where it is, where a cultural trait becomes sin. You know, where it's so, I guess maybe it's the point where that cultural trait becomes so dominant that it becomes almost an idol within the culture and distorts the way we look at God and the world. I don't know. But I see that often happening in American individualism. There's something sinful, you know, when so many people in New York City watch a woman being stabbed to death on the street, you know, and then say afterwards, well, that wasn't my responsibility. That's sort of American individualism dropped off the edge. And so from that point of view, I think we do need a return to this, the biblical emphasis on the family and calling families to Christ. I remember, we got to quit. I was in Mexico about 3 years ago and attending a meeting, evangelistic crusade of Luis Palau, who is sort of the Mexican, Latin American Billy Graham. But one of the things that really impressed me, we were in a bull ring, services were in a bull ring, and very well attended. And this was the first time in this particular city where an evangelical meeting had ever been allowed to be held in a public area. So it was a big breakthrough. And when Luis Palau came to the part where he made the call, he appealed to the families. He didn't talk about individuals. He said, just sort of putting it together, generalizing, he said, you know, fathers, you're sitting there with your wife and your children, come to Christ, bring your families. Mother, you're there with your two children and your father's at home, bring your children, come to Christ. And he very specifically drew in the whole family as he called for the people. And what amazes you then was you stood there and watched, you saw whole families come down off of the bull ring and up to the front. Now, It can be done, and I thought he was very effectively using a very effective contextualizer. He knew where he was going in that kind of situation. And it can be done. I was struck as I was reading this, what's the significance of the fact that in Luke 10, for example, Jesus says that cities will be judged at the last day. He says, woe unto you, Chorazin, woe unto you, Bethsaida. He said, if the mighty works had been done in you, that if the mighty works that were done in you had been done in Sodom and Gomorrah, they would have repented long ago in ashes. It will be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for you. Now, does that mean, is Jesus talking generally there? Is he thinking of cities as just great big piles of individuals, but he does single out whole sociological units for judgment. Will the Lord judge? What do we mean when we say the Lord will judge the nations? Boy, I don't know. What does Matthew 24 say, mean when it says that our witness will be given to all the ethne before the Lord comes? I'm really serious. I'm not sure I do know what some of those things mean. I am fearful that they are uprooted from their context by some of the exegetical work associated with the Church Growth School, and there's a lot of distortion here. And I want to recognize that, but on the other hand, too, we've got to recognize that there is a richness to that language that we have not explored really fully biblically and grappled with. And maybe the work that's being done by Dayton and McGavern and others is going to help us do that. Anyway, that's what a people is.